are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 7th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Eric Blanc, author of Red State Revolt, Teachers' Strikes, and Working Class Politics. Also on the program today, it's impossible because, of course, there was no underlying crime, or so we've been told, but 500 prosecutors, 500 former federal prosecutors say Trump would have been charged with obstruction were he not president. Also on the program today, Steve Mnuchin appoints himself Supreme Court Justice and rules he is not compelled by the law to release Trump's taxes to House committees.
Just doesn't feel right, okay?
Meanwhile, Kamala Harris calls for full Trump tax repeal. Boeing knew about safety alert problems on the 737 for a year without telling the FAA. New York Attorney General sues IRS and Treasury for ignoring records requests. The White House Office of Management and Budget floats redefining poverty to make it harder for folks to get food and child support. Meanwhile, Donald Trump pardons a war criminal. And new video taken by Sandra Bland released prompts calls to reopen her case. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. forgive me. I think you probably have already noticed. I have what I think is the early development of a cold, sore throat. Throat is slowly contracting, and I'm anticipating by the end of this program, I will not be able to breathe. So we shall see and endeavor to persevere as we go forward. But I am buoyed by this Jerry Falwell tweet from yesterday. He writes, this is Jerry Falwell Jr., sadly, the original Jerry Falwell has left the building, as it were, headed up, of course, to heaven, where guys like him go. And after the best week ever for Donald Trump, he writes, no obstruction, no collusion. New York Times admits Barack Obama did spy on his campaign, and the economy is soaring. I now support reparations. Trump should have 2 years added to his first term as payback for time stolen by this corrupt failed coup. This, of course, was retweeted by the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Hard cosign.
Good tweet, good post.
RT's eco endorsements.
I mean, this is, you know, Donald Trump's strategy is to, and there's going to be a theme here today, actually, is to rally the support of a narrow group of people in this country to maintain the the support of his base. And we'll hear, too, I think, from Eric Blanc in, when we talk about the teacher strikes. For years, I've been doing this on, you know, radio or some form or another. And the least informed critique I have ever received about doing this stuff. The most consistent and least informed critique has been, you're just preaching to the choir. I think what people are starting to come to understand is it's the choir who actually determines the outcome of a lot of these things. It was the choir, as it were, maybe even the clergy, who were responsible for these strikes across the country, or at least the catalyst for it. And we're starting to realize that I think there's broader understanding that more and more you have to play to your base, and not just play to your base, but motivate your base, because they are the people that go out and do all the work. There is a significant percentage of the American public who are simply along for the ride, and you need to have your base go pick them up at their homes and get them involved in stuff, whether it's voting, or these are not mutually exclusive activities, but activism and whatnot, organizing. And so Donald Trump knows this. I mean, he's trolling, and he writes following that, despite the tremendous success that I've had as president, including perhaps the greatest economy and most successful 2 years of any president in history.
Tell me about it. Preach.
They have stolen 2 years of my, and then he's kind enough to put in parentheses, our presidency, and more parentheses, collusion delusion, that we will never be able to get back. Witch hunt is over, but we will never forget. Which, of course, is a slogan about that they use about the Holocaust. We will never forget. Make America great again. And there it is. Donald Trump calling for reparations, hoping to get a 6-year term for his presidency. And, you know, you start to figure out the calculations. I think he's thinking, if I can stay in the presidency until my 80s, I am going to bet that no court will sentence me to prison after I get out. Because, I mean, look, on a day when 500 former prosecutors say that were it not for the Department of Justice's finding that you cannot indict a sitting president, therefore, that being policy amongst anyone who is working for the Department of Justice, i.e. Mueller, Donald Trump would have been charged with obstruction of justice. The whole point why you have obstruction of justice is because it obstructs your ability to seek justice. In other words, it prevents law enforcement from being able to prove a possible crime. It's quite clear from the report that Mueller is laying out saying that there are instances where we just don't really know. We don't have access to this, but we clearly have less because of the lying and of the trading for pardons and whatnot. And there is increasing speculation and assessment of the report that basically, and in fact, Mueller writes it in the report, we are attempting to memorialize the evidence here so that it doesn't go stale for when the president leaves the office. And the reason why you do that is not just for the history books. And so, you know, I'm sure Donald Trump is very, very interested in winning a second term, because it's probably, despite the fact that the White House is a little bit rougher than he's used to and he likes Mar-a-Lago, still more comfortable than prison.
There's executive time. There's ways of making do.
Right, exactly. If I sleep long enough into the day, it doesn't bother me.
A lot of, you know, leaders, Putin, Mugabe, a big part of their calculus was, if I leave this specific location, I'll probably get into some significant trouble. That's definitely where Trump is at.
But we'll talk about this later in the program. Pardoning a war criminal really sends a great message. And I'm being literal The guy spent 5 years in prison for a war crime. So we will get to all that and more. And of course, we'll be talking to Eric Blanc, who I've spoken to a couple of times on Ring of Fire Radio, who has been covering really, I mean, I guess the biggest element of what we've seen in a resurgence of labor actions across the country over the past year and change. In fact, I think there's one going on still right now in Tennessee involving teachers. We'll talk to Eric about that. In the meantime, folks, we're just a couple of days away from Mother's Day, and it's coming up, and there's nothing we wouldn't do to make sure the special moms in our lives are happy. Sherry's Berries has special Mother's Day berries designed just for mom. They're topped with chocolate chips, pink shimmer sugar, and swizzles. I should note, because I see them so vividly in my mind right now. Those are three different toppings on the strawberries. All equally delicious. And you get to choose the delivery date to ensure that mom gets your gift of Sherry's Berries exactly when you want her to. Better yet, your satisfaction is always guaranteed. The berries are delicious. They come packed in a sort of a cooler type of situation that keeps them absolutely fresh. Your mom will open up, and if you're smart, you will be there when they arrive, and you will get double order so that you will eat. You can eat literally six of them, and she will still have plenty for herself. Don't wait until the last minute on this one. Visit berries.com today to order freshly dipped strawberries at $19.99 for mom or moms in your life, and to make mom really happy, or in my case, so that you can eat just as many berries as she does. You can double the berries for just $10 more. Mother's Day is Sunday, May 12th. Visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Enter my code CEDAR. That's berries.com. Click on the microphone. Enter the code CEDAR. Not just for Mother's Day, but a very good gift for Mother's Day. Also, do you like the thrill of an escape room? Looking for clues and solving puzzles? I play a lot of Clue with my kids.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they really do like that. Introducing Hunt a Killer. It's a monthly subscription game where you become a detective immersed in a murder mystery. Each month, you'll receive crime scene photos, evidence, motive, and a suspect information that you'll need to use to solve a crime. It's so interactive and convincing that it looks and feels real. You'll be racking your brain to solve the mystery and anxiously awaiting the next box of clues. It's perfect to play solo, during date night, or with friends for a game night so you can swap theories. Started to do this a little bit with Mile. It got a little bit intense for her. But it's cool. You wait for...
Wait, intense? Like, were you like that Dave Chappelle sketch where he had the Make-A-Wish kid gets to play video games with him and he ends up terrorizing the kid? Is that what you mean?
No, not quite. But it's super cool waiting for those the next clues that you get. And it's nice to not have it all be, you know, in your hand, as it were, with the phones. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry up to take advantage of this offer. It's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box, huntakiller.com/majority. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Eric Blanc. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Don't forget, you can support this show by becoming a member and supporting the program, getting extra content every day, getting it commercial-free by heading to jointhemajorityreport.com. Now on the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program Eric Blanc. He is a former high school teacher, writes about labor, and author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave, and Working Class Politics. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Thanks for having me back on.
So, Eric, we've spoken in the past on Ring of Fire as radio, as a lot of these strikes were happening over the course of 2018. And we really did have a resurgence of labor activity by teachers, particularly in states that haven't seen much labor action in years. Let's start with West Virginia. What brought about that, you know, what were the different forces that spurred that strike?
Well, in some ways, the big story is how similar the conditions are for teachers across the country. So in West Virginia, like in most states, pay has been stagnating. There's been a real concerted underfunding of schools, particularly since the Great Recession, a push towards privatization. And generally speaking, there hasn't been the type of mass resistance until very recently, despite these conditions. And so really one of the particularities of West Virginia is that, in part because there's no collective bargaining and the unions are relatively weaker, that created a bit of a political vacuum in which a relatively small group of radical teachers who first got organized together through the Bernie Sanders campaign and then the Democratic Socialists of America group that came out of that, they were able to take the lead in late 2017 to fight in the direction of a strike to stop a proposed increase of almost two times the cost for healthcare. And so they really initiated this rank-and-file upsurge that then in turn spread across the country.
So the paradox here is that the lack of an institution allowed for more aggressive elements, I guess, amongst the teachers to step in, like is what you're saying. And let me ask you this. How much, before we go, you know, any further with talking about the dynamics of these strikes, how much did No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top impact this? Because I just remember talking to elementary school teachers of my daughters, you know, maybe 10 years ago, and them telling me, some of the older teachers saying that, you know, the younger teachers who come in, they don't have the sort of same sense of what they can do as a teacher, and it disempowers them across the board. But was there any, I mean, was the so-called education reform movement of the late aughts, or the aughts in the early teens, was that implicated at all in any of this?
Oh yeah, it's a huge part of the story, because really what you're seeing is, on the one hand, stagnating pay, worse working conditions, and in turn, combined with that, you have just the practice of being a decent teacher has been made much harder by this over-testing regime in particular, and an overall kind of disciplining and semi-authoritarian incursion into the classroom in which teachers are really prevented from having the necessary autonomy to be good teachers and instead start teaching to the book, start teaching to the test. And so you have this combination of factors in which teachers want to do a good job. You know, a lot of us get into the profession because we believe in what we are doing, but the corporate ed reform pushed by the Democrats just as much, and in some ways even more than the Republicans, made doing our job increasingly difficult. And that plus the low pay and underfunding has set up a very explicit mix.
So, all right, so let's go back to West Virginia. I mean, and what was unique? Because West Virginia basically started a rash of strikes, if you will, that went from West Virginia to Virginia, Oklahoma, I guess North Carolina and Kentucky, Georgia, Colorado, Arizona, ultimately in L.A. this year, and South Carolina, North Carolina in the past couple of weeks, not even past week or so. So, all right. So, but what was unique about West Virginia relative to those other states? Were there other elements? I mean, you talked about this, the political vacuum that is a function of it being a right to work state. Were there other dynamics that were taking place there that were unique to West Virginia?
Yeah, there's a few things going on. There's a reason it started in West Virginia, and I think part of that is the history of labor militancy in the state. You know, this gets overdrawn a little bit. Some of the mainstream reports gave the impression that, you know, everyone there is coal miners' son or daughter, and it's not exactly like that. But there's an aspect of truth to that story, particularly in the beginning parts of the strike, where, you know, there was a very deep fear across the state, in West Virginia, like in other states, to take an illegal action. These were strikes that broke the law. You know, public sector strikes are illegal in most states of the country, including West Virginia. And it took the initial kind of daringness sort of courage of teachers in the southern part of West Virginia, Mingo County, Wyoming County, in which there really is still a very real tradition of labor militancy that does have its roots going back almost a century to the mine wars of the early 20th century. And there, they really put their neck out for the rest of the state and ultimately the rest of the country by doing some initial one-day walkouts that inspired other teachers across the state, and that in turn inspired people across the country. So I do think that history of labor militancy, at least in this pocket of southern West Virginia, served as a catalyst that explains why West Virginia was first.
And just also, just, you know, outline for us, there are unions or associations there, right? I mean, explain to us just what the dynamic is in terms of like the institutions that exist there. And I'm curious as to what your sense is of what they learned.
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, there are actually three education unions in West Virginia. For the most part, like most unions across the country, they've limited themselves over the last years and decades to lobbying the Democratic Party. And that has been ineffective in large part because the Democratic Party went in power in West Virginia, which actually ran West Virginia for 80 straight years as almost one party rule up until just 2014, you know, imposed really draconian budget cuts and anti-working class policies. So it's understandable why neither the unions nor the Democratic Party has a kind of enthusiasm that one might expect. So the unions really had to get pushed into supporting these strikes. To their credit, for the most part, they did eventually come on board. The union leaderships were reticent, but under pressure ended up supporting the strikes. And that was important because the unions did provide resources and an infrastructure in West Virginia for the strikes to cohere, even if the leaderships of these unions didn't take the initial impetus. And so I think it's a little bit unclear, to be honest, what the lessons learned by the union leadership is. You know, we should distinguish the members from the top representatives. One of the exciting things about West Virginia and a lot of these other strikes is that in their wake, there's been thousands of people have joined the union, and some of these radical rank and filers who really pushed towards the strike have also won local, if not statewide, office and have pushed to build a caucus and to really do the type of transformative organizational and political change that would be necessary to have real lasting power and have a union that doesn't just have to get pushed at the last minute into supporting actions, but can actually initiate a strategic campaign.
Okay, so you had this first strike in West Virginia. It was resolved about 3 weeks later, right? I think the first week of March or so, or maybe the second week of March.
Yeah, that's right.
And so how much And then we saw, then shortly after that, we saw one in Virginia that was a little bit more limited. But then we saw Oklahoma, and we saw Arizona and Colorado and Georgia. Did folks from West Virginia head there? I mean, how much was being communicated there? How much were these strikes like sort of cross-pollinating each other?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's probably useful to think of that running on a few different parallel tracks. The big story is that when West Virginia happened, it captured the imagination of teachers across the country. It partly because it was such an explosive, really inspirational strike. It did garner a lot of attention, both more organically through social media and also through the national press. So it caught the imagination of teachers, particularly in red states, who, you know, for years have felt that actually nothing could be done to stop this sort of onslaught against their profession and against schools, because they didn't have the right to strike, they didn't have strong unions, they didn't have collective bargaining, so they just had to take it. And all of a sudden, almost virtually overnight, West Virginia snapped that and gave people a sense of hope and courage and determination. And one of the really interesting things when I did interviews for the book and also just traveling around is over and over and over again, I would hear the same story from the organizers of these strikes in other states, that they said, you know, for us, things were actually really kind of dead. There was very low momentum until West Virginia, and then West Virginia lit a fire in our state and gave us a sense that something different was possible. So that's on the big level. And then there was some discussion in between some of the key organizers about strategies and tactics. Labor Notes, which is sort of the left wing of the labor movement, provided an important space for that to happen, where organically some of the rank and file teachers could trade lessons, could talk about steps, could organize solidarity for one another. One of the really exciting kind of remarkable aspects of these strikes is how much the role of solidarity, and particularly things like sending money for food and pizza, or just taking photos of oneself in your school and support of strikers elsewhere. It was a really central aspect of the strikes, in part because the major national unions, at least in 2018, did not really step up to support the strikes like they should have. They've done a little bit better now. But at the time, it really had to be much more organic over social media and these relatively loose networks to support the other teachers going out on strike. So you have a broad process of inspiration and then some cross-pollination strategically through key organizers.
Interesting. So in many respects, the West Virginia ended up being sort of the emperor has no clothes moment for other strikers or potential strikers, I guess, to realize the power they had within their labor. So talk to me about the relationship between the strikers and the community at large, because this is something that, you know, I think we saw first with the Chicago teachers strike. Now, I guess 7-8 years ago, this notion of, maybe we didn't see it first, but we saw it most prominently, I think, in recent times, this notion of social justice unionism, where, and teachers are very well situated for this, obviously, because of the nature of the relationship between teachers and the students and the parents of students and the community. But how much was that in practice, where the strikers, the union, were garnering community support and actually, you know, fighting on behalf of the community in many respects?
Yeah, the huge part of the story. Public sector strikes in general and teacher strikes in particular really depend on winning and maintaining public support. You can't really win a strike without that, because unlike in the private sector, you don't have the power to halt profits. And so your leverage in large part is by garnering public support, creating a crisis, and then channeling that anger and sort of crisis dynamic against the politicians. So the the need to win over the public is not a secondary question. It's really central. And as you mentioned, Chicago in 2012 did really set into motion a much broader understanding amongst teacher activists of the potential for this kind of alliance building. And so in West Virginia, that took a lot of different forms. Part of it, maybe most famously, was that the teachers, before beginning their strike, spent a lot of time preparing food and bagged lunches to give to their students, because in West Virginia, like in most states, working class students depend on the free lunch and often free breakfast provided. And so to undercut the media and politician narrative that teachers were hurting their students by going on strike, the teachers spent a huge amount of time and financial resources to make sure that food was provided. And in fact, after spending 8, 9, 10 hours on the picket line or at the Capitol, very often they would spend hours in the evening hand-delivering bagged lunches to families so that students could eat the next day. So small actions like that made a big difference, and then also bigger demands on behalf of students and really working-class families generally were just as important. You know, so in Oklahoma and Arizona, the major demands of the strike, in addition to pay, were just for more funding for students, that students needed to be able to have classrooms in which their chairs weren't broken, in which the roofs weren't leaking, in which they had textbooks 15 years old. And these types of demands made it clear to the public at large that the strikes weren't just quote-unquote greedy teachers, but were in fact strikes on behalf of students and parents as well.
So what that particular element, and I'm curious as to, you know, if there's any theories or, you know, principles that have come out of the experience that these teachers have had that you spoke to, where that dynamic can be replicated in contexts where there isn't, it's just frankly just not so easy or, you know, I mean, in this instance, it's like, okay, the teachers have a very clear, you know, advocacy role for their students. They have already pre-existing relationships with and benefit of the doubt from parents, right, who deal with them on a daily basis, very often want to talk to them anyways. How are those, that element, right, extrapolated for, let's say, like, people who are working in sanitation departments or people who are working, you know, in the highway workers or whatever it is? Like, how is there been work on, as far as you know, not just, you know, this cross-pollination in terms of teacher to teacher from state to state, but teachers to other public sector workers who have, you know, communicating those ideas?
Yeah, there's definitely initiatives in that direction. Part of the dynamic is, as you mentioned, that there is something strategic about the position that teachers are in as far as their direct interaction with a huge amount of public. That being said, if we take a step back, there's quite a few industries that are similar. So the most obvious parallel is healthcare, and a lot of healthcare is public. And so it's not a surprise, I think, that the other sector of industry other than education, where you've seen a significant number of strikes recently, has been healthcare. The dynamics are very similar. You have nurses struggling for a lower nurse-to-patient ratios, which is an almost exact parallel to teachers fighting for lower class size, which was a major demand, for instance, in Los Angeles. So there's quite a few industries in which the public interface can be leveraged. And I think other public sector jobs are similar. You can make a case that if, for instance, you want better public transportation, well, you need to have more funding for public transportation. And part of that is hiring more workers. It's part of that is expanding public transportation so that, for instance, you can move away from the fossil fuel complex. There's huge implications if you just take a step back around the Green New Deal for expanding the public sector and having unions who right now might be very narrowly focused on just the interests of their members. If they're able to raise the demand to expand public services for all and to lower costs, actually, that's a very direct point of leverage that can be used. The reason it hasn't been is not because it's impossible, but for the same reasons it hasn't been leveraged in education until recently, is that you didn't really have enough rank and filers and radicals pushing in that direction. I think that one of the real particularities then of education is that for various reasons, you have more left-leaning workers, you know, people who go into it maybe the profession because of social justice reasons. So you have a critical mass that can push. But historically, these other industries in the 30s, 40s, even well into the 50s, did employ a sort of social justice unionism in which they fought not just for their members, but for working class as a whole. So I don't think there's a structural reason why that can't be spread. The main difficulty is just resources, and you need people in pushing in that direction.
I mean, are we, when we look at this, are we looking at when we say why now, is it a function of just simply, you know, time plus deprivation? At one point, the camel's back breaks, or is it that there are people going into this profession now who have more radical ideas, or is it just simply a combination? I mean, are what we looking at, you know, sort of like the natural progression coming out of the financial crisis, that you have a generation of people who have much less opportunity, so they're much more open to the idea of fighting to get, you know, some basic pay and services, and they go into the teacher's profession, and this is a profession that has been, you know, repeatedly denied over years. I mean, is it a combination of those things, or is there one factor more prominent than the other?
That's a really good question. I think it's hard to separate these out insofar as the general conditions that the economic recession and austerity and really decades of neoliberalism created are the same conditions that led a smaller group of people to become organized radicals. And so the way that that context plays out is different for, let's say, a Republican voting teacher who went out on strike. They're ideologically not as committed to some sort of social justice strategy, but in practice are moving in the same direction and are willing to fight back. And then those same conditions certainly inform the trajectory of a smaller group of folks who radicalized through the Bernie Sanders campaign and then took the initiative on these strikes. So, you know, taking a step back, what I see as the really unique thing about the strike wave is how reflective it is of broader social dynamics in the country. And it's one of the reasons why it doesn't feel, and there's no indication that this is a one-off, because as you mentioned, it's a reaction against not just this or that policy, but really a generalized underfunding of the public sector. And I think in some ways it's reflective of a disenchantment with the political center and the status quo in the United States as a whole. So the same type of phenomena that you see with the rise of Bernie Sanders, the rebirth of a socialist movement through the kind of reborn Democratic Socialists of America and the strike wave, all of these both feed off of each other in very concrete ways and are reflective of a generalized push in the direction of more radical, more working class politics.
So give us a sense of just, you know, how these strikes turned out. I mean, we're talking about West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, and Georgia, Colorado, Arizona, North Carolina, L.A. There was a strike at the beginning of this year. There was one-day walkouts, if I'm not mistaken, in South Carolina and in North Carolina earlier, just last week. And Tennessee is having a sick out. Are these all being successful? I mean, I've heard some talk at one point that West Virginia's just, teachers were going to go back out on strike recently. What has been the outcome of this? And then we'll get to, you're going to tell us what the future is going to bring.
Oh, I'll be excited to hear as well what the future is going to bring. The short version is that these strikes have won more in about a year than decades of the old strategy of lobbying the Democrats. You've seen huge gains, 20% pay raise in Arizona, the defeat of charters and privatization in West Virginia. West Virginia won not only in 2018, but they had a new illegal two-day political strike to stop a latest attempt by the Republicans to impose charters and vouchers in West Virginia, and they had another strike just this year. I think the Los Angeles strike in particular is really the highest, most powerful expression of the wave so far, and in some ways won the most because it wasn't just a defensive battle, but proactively put forward new demands to transform and win the types of public schools that, you know, as their slogan said, the schools that our students deserve. So it won things like lower class sizes. It won anti-racist demands like a fund funded by the district to support immigrant families who are facing deportation. It stopped random searches of Black and Muslim students. A whole slew of real qualitative changes to the schools, in addition to more funding for nurses and counselors, things like this. So the story is that the strikes are winning. They've not come really close yet to the fundamental transformation and improvement of the school system. To do that, you can't do that in just one strike. You also probably can't do it solely through strikes. And that's part of the reason why in California and in some of the other states, there's an effort to now use the energy of the strike movement into creating a more strategic campaign around winning funding, really billions of dollars in funding for schools, and systematically defeating the privatization movement. So that requires a political intervention in the state, both by electing pro-education people and having initiatives and ballot initiatives. So I think that ultimately the movement has really just begun. And the exciting thing is that there's a cross-pollination between these strikes and things like the Bernie Sanders campaign, which is supporting the strikes, and then in turn the strikes are supporting the Bernie Sanders campaign. Because I do think ultimately you're going to need political power to have the deep-seated changes. Strikes are amazing and important, but not enough on their own.
I was going to ask you that as the last question. Do you think that the strikes and the success that these teachers' associations and unions and just groups have had over the past year have altered the calculus with the Democratic presidential candidates? I mean, maybe this is, you know, sort of a little bit outside your portfolio, but I'm wondering if maybe presidential candidates is too broad. Do they feel like these teachers feel like they have strength in their hand with politicians? Because I spoke to Randy Weingarten, and I think it was also the VP of the AFT. Maybe it was at the DNC in 2016. And one of the reasons why they articulated to me that they endorsed Clinton so quickly was they felt like they were shut out at the table during the Obama administration, when we did have the sort of the height of the corporate education reform movement. And Arne Duncan, who represented all of that, came in and created this race to the top, I guess. Is there a different dynamic since these strikes?
Yeah, very different dynamic. The proof is in the pudding as far as what works to change the national political conversation and what works to force elites, including the Democratic Party establishment, to change their tune. It, contrary to the perspective of Randy Weingarten and the most union leaders, it wasn't by, you know, getting a seat at the table through early endorsements that any of this changed, but in fact it was by building power independently of the state and employers and both parties that forced a change in consciousness around things like corporate education reform. So the illustration of that is now the Democratic Party, including people who have taken millions of dollars from charters, people like Cory Booker and others, have nominally distanced themselves from the charter movement. It's become quite controversial within the Democratic Party now to come out in favor of privatization. Like, we shouldn't overestimate that, in the sense that the Democratic Party has a long history of making promises and breaking them. But the fact that now, at least nominally, they have to make gestures and talk about why teacher pay needs to go up, why privatization hasn't worked, is a game changer, and it legitimizes the struggle, and it turns a reflection of the real impact that struggle has had nationally. But, you know, ultimately, it's there's a contradiction still between the fact that teachers and their unions and the students who are fighting for these changes to their schools are coming up against a political system that is funded by billionaires that really want to continue to see the dismantling of public sector for the benefit of private charters. And that contradiction will play an important role in the 2020 debates. And we're hoping that through things like Educators for Bernie and Labor for Bernie, and then more strikes in general, that that can force the issue of putting public education and the teacher strike wave at the fore of what any viable contender to beat Trump will have to raise. And so that, in some ways, the stakes are pretty high.
Eric Blanc, Red State Revolt, the teacher strike wave, and working class politics. We will put a link at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you become a member, not only does an angel get its wings, but also you get more content. Nearly every single solitary day. On top of which, you get the show commercial free. So you will not hear commercials. But you can always go to the podcast descriptions to hear them. You just go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Sign up. Become a member. Pennies a day. Also, reminder, Hunt a Killer, it's a monthly subscription game where you become a detective immersed in a murder mystery. It's so interactive and convincing that it looks and feels real. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. They only accept 200 members per day, so hurry, take advantage of this offer. That's huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. huntakiller.com/majority. All right, folks. today is Tuesday. Michael will tell you what happens tonight in this very space that we sit in. Then Jamie, and then Matt. And I will be right back as you go.
Who did the job? Who was the killer? Milo, we need to find out.
That actually, some of that might happen tonight. We also, are you guys cutting to me? Okay, so tonight, first of all, at 6 p.m., we're doing another one of these. We're doing another one of these pre-main show live streams, which we're going to be doing from time to time. Not necessarily every Tuesday, but on some Tuesdays. This Tuesday, the great Mike Hanna is joining us. South Africa's voting tomorrow. And he is, of course, an iconic South African journalist. And we're going to be covering the campaign. We're going to be talking about the various political parties, the market and ecological dimensions of the crisis in South Africa and how it affects the broader Southern African politics. Now, that live stream will be at 6 p.m. And then on the main show, I believe Renique Allen is joining us to talk about It Was All a Dream. Biggie Smalls, Black Millennials. We're talking about Extinction Rebellion. And then the great Ben Burgess is in studio. We're talking about Marx, Hegel, the Zizek-Peterson debate, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, patreon.com/TMBS to get all of the illicit histories, idea primers, and theory readings.
All right. Is that it?
That's it.
This week on the Antifada, we have unlocked our new series, Prolet Cult, in which producer AP Andy talks about UFOs, conspiracy theories, the paranormal, the parasocial, and the parapolitical from a Marxist perspective. Quick programming note on that. We unlocked it on Patreon, but only Andy has the raw file that we need to upload to our free stream on fans.fm. And he's currently in Cuba at the first ever Trotskyism conference held in Cuba, but he'll be back soon to put that into the stream for you guys. We also recorded an episode with Katie Halper over the weekend, which will be out tomorrow, in which we talk about the 90s, both the silly pop culture ephemera, as well as the real political and economic currents that had a real effect on politics today. We also sing a new parody song, or we start to, and we're going to sing the rest of it, or Katie is, at the live show on Friday, which I also want to plug. If any of you are in the New York City area, come out to Littlefield Friday, this Friday, 8 p.m. I'm going to be appearing at the Katie Halper and Struggle Session live show, along with Jake Flores, Matt Taibbi, and all of the Struggle Session folks. So check it out.
Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover. Upcoming this weekend is going to be the Song of Hiawatha, a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. After that, it's going to be an essay for patrons of my Orweller series, George Orwell, Such Were the Joys, his time at private school, and also going to be in Rutger Bregman's Utopia for Realists in the coming months. Talk about UBI and the sort of promise and pitfalls of that policy.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Je vous remercie.